Session number 10009, Reel 4.
Mr. Scannell, Reel 4.
Yes, I was brought up very much in the sort of backwash, the aftermath of the war. So stories of my uncles and my father were talking about the trenches, and very much the tunes were still in the air, the songs, the trenches of the wartime songs, and A Long, Long Trail, and If You Were the Only Girl in the World. These were the sort of popular songs of the time. Not so much the marching songs. I know that I went to the Imperial War Museum's exhibition on the First World War, a few years ago this was, and I was very impressed by the fact that the galleries were sort of done out almost like trenches, communication trenches, with duckboards and so on. The various exhibits, it was it First World? I think it was First World, was it entitled Poetry? I think it was, Blunden's Military Cross and his uniform and letters and notebooks, Edward Thomas's clay pipe and various map case and things, and Siegfried Sassoon and stuff. But what they had, while one was going around the exhibits, there was music being played. And what they'd chosen to do, I think very subtly, not what one might have expected, the obvious pack up for the troubles in your bag and Tipperary and all that kind of thing at all. They were the musical comedy, big hits from a show called The Bing Boys Are Here, I believe, If You Were the Only Girl in the World, and songs like that, terribly sentimental, played on a wind-up gramophone. And it was most effective. It was eerie, haunting, and strange. And I thought that was a very clever touch. I don't know who chose to do that. But these were the tunes, and this was the time. And it seems to me, and I also remember very vividly, Armistice Days when I was a child, because I actually wore my father's medals. He got his medals out, and I would have them on my jersey or jacket or whatever I was wearing, and we would go along to the. They made much more of the Armistice Remembrance Day when I was a child, and the old soldiers would all parade with their medals and march through, and there would be an open-air service in the town square. And of course, this was going on all over England, and it was all celebrated at school. And it was a very militaristic occasion, in fact. I mean, it was sort of... I still feel uneasy. One is moved by it, or was moved by it. I don't know about now. But there was a kind of glorification of war itself, I think.
On this question of the attitude towards war and what, in relation to what you were saying about the personal quality of your own poetry, your own war poetry, I was thinking about poems like the Iliad, where you get almost certainly a depiction of heroism, almost a glorification of heroism.
Oh, yes,
in
yes.
War poems like that. Do you think... That's something which can never be recaptured in modern times?
I suspect so. I think one would you know, any kind of poetry, the sort of glorification of the martial values now, I think would be viewed very, very suspiciously. And I, of course, with the nature of war, with the more detached and scientific and technological nature of war, which is steadily increasing, that kind of heroism, that kind of heroic view, is much more difficult to convey or to convince anybody of. I mean, now when the person who's going to kill you is probably just pressing a button or pulling a lever or whatever, and of course, I mean, well, probably one doesn't want to think about nuclear war, but I mean, certainly the martial values have no part in a nuclear war, do they? And even now, you know, the war just seems to me utterly squalid and vile and inhuman. But then I think it always was, actually. I don't think that being hacked to pieces with a broadsword is any more romantic than being blown to bits by shrapnel.
In In fact, that kind of personal combat must have been quite horrific.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. I'm sure. These big battles must have been unbelievably horrible, yes. And, you know, from what one reads, a little bit someone reads about Agincourt, for instance, I remember reading an account of, and they were quite horrific, the wounds and the carnage.
I mean, in the incident in your own book, where you come close to personal contact in the Bocage,
yes,
in Normandy,
mm,
your feelings then must have been one of terror, really, of being so close to the Germans.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. Yes, and they are sort of nightmare figures in a way. They're sort of bogeyman figures in my imagination, in my memory. They still, I don't see them in, I see them as threatening and frightening figures.
You've recently had published in The Spectator a poem called War Graves at El Alamein. I wonder if you can say something about how you came to write that poem.
Well, I think it was just to do with the same business I've been talking about, doing this whole sequence of military poems, which I'm probably going to call Soldiering On, I think is probably the overall title for them. And I've just been thinking a great deal about war. And this one, I don't know whether this is really very good or not. I don't think it is, probably. But it did strike me that what I tried to get into this was something of the nightmarish quality of war. And it struck me that those who were killed, I've written among these poems a real ballad. They're not all ballads, but one is a ballad called I think it's called Remembering Alamein, and it's spoken through the word, through the voice. I use the persona of an old sweat of a soldier talking to young recruits in the barrack room about Alamein. It's a sort of longish ballad in which he talks of the pipers, because they actually use pipers in after Alamein. They didn't, because they virtually all got killed because there was absolute targets. But the pipers actually played you into battle. They actually were there at the entrance of the minefield blowing the pipes as the Highland Division went in. And there was something mad and heroic, I suppose, about it, but something terribly sad too, I think, somehow. So. And after that, they didn't. They acted as stretcher bearers, actually, our pipers did, after that.
I wonder if you could possibly read that poem that we've just mentioned, and maybe Walking Wounded again for us, please.
Right. This is one called War Graves at El Alamein. When they were little children, they explored forests dense with dangers, were pursued by beast or giant wielding knife or sword, and terrified, they found their feet were glued firmly to the ground. They could not scream or run. Yet they were never stabbed or gored, but always woke to find it just a dream. Years and nightmares later, they became old enough to put on uniform, and in parched throats they gagged upon the same taste of childhood terror. In a storm of killing thunder they must battle through. Now, unimportant pieces in the game, they sleep and know that last bad dream was true. And this is Walking Wounded. A mammoth morning moved grey flanks and groaned. In the rusty hedges pale rags of mist hung. The gruel of mud and leaves in the mauled lane smelt sweet like blood. Birds had died or flown, their green and silent attics sprouting now with branches of leafed steel, hiding round eyes and ripe grenades ready to drop and burst. In the ditch at the crossroads, the fallen rider lay hugging his dead machine, and did not stir at crunch of mortar, tantrum of a Bren answering a Spandau's manic jabber. Then into sight the ambulances came, stumbling and churning past the broken farm, the amputated signpost and smashed trees, slow wagon loads of bandaged cries, square trucks that rolled on ominous wheels, vehicles made mythopoeic by their mortal freight and crimson crosses on the dirty white. This grave procession passed, though for a while the grinding of their engines could be heard, a dark noise on the pallor of the morning, dark as dried blood. And then it faded, died. The road was empty, but it seemed to wait, like a stage which knows the cast is in the wings, wait for a different traffic to appear. The mist still hung in snags from dripping thorns. Absent-minded guns still sighed and thumped. And then they came, the walking wounded, straggling the road like convicts loosely chained, dragging at ankles exhaustion and despair. Their heads were weighted down by last night's lead, and eyes still drank the dark. They trailed the night along the morning road. Some limped on sticks, others wore rough dressings, splints and slings. A few had turbaned heads, the dirty cloth brown badged with blood. A humble brotherhood. Not one was suffering from a lethal hurt. They were not magnified by noble wounds. There was no splendour in that company. And yet, remembering after 18 years, in the heart's throat a sour sadness stirs. Imagination pauses and returns to see them walking still, but multiplied in thousands now. And when heroic corpses turn slowly in their decorated sleep, and every ambulance has disappeared, the walking wounded still trudge down that lane, and when recalled, they must bear arms again. Probably, I'd just like to finish by making it clear that I am not, although I am certainly anti-war, I do believe that the Second World War, although there weren't my reasons for being involved in it to the extent that I was involved, I do believe it was what the Christians call a just war. I don't believe that there was any alternative, really, in the face of the monstrous fascist regime. I think it had to be fought against. Reluctantly, I believe that, but I don't believe that the pacifist stance would have worked there at all. I think it would have been disastrous. Also, I do have the greatest admiration for the real courage, for physical courage. I don't possess it myself, and probably that's why I admire it. So I do admire it immensely. And I'm not trying to justify my own desertion in action at all. I don't. My book, The Argument of Kings, is not a justification. It is merely a dramatization of the events. I think that, and I do hope that people who read it will. Well, at least perhaps understand a little of the incredible strain and horrors of war, particularly for the young and not especially well equipped.